You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
We are back. I'm going to take a minute at the top here to talk about Save Our Stages. Hashtag Save Our Stages. This was recorded on Thursday, August 20th, 2020. You're listening to this podcast, so I do not have to tell you about the value that independent venues bring to our society. Venues are projected to lose up to $9 billion of revenue if the rest of 2020 remains, quote-unquote, dark with no shows, which seems to be the case. Every fucking band and artist you love came up playing small independent venues all over the country. It's been breaking our heart every day to hear about places that we came up playing at closing and pleading for help. Places like Red 7 in Austin, Great Scott in Boston, The Mothlight, The Loft in Michigan are all closed. It's insane. And word is Grog Shop in Ohio and Metro in Chicago, one of my favorite all-time places on this earth, are struggling. This is where it happens. This is where, you know, out-of-tour musicians work. This is where our crew and everyone else's crew works while they're not on tour. This is where you meet your husband. This is where you realize what you want to do with your life. This is where you meet your friends after the fucking work week. Like, whatever. This is where it all makes sense, and they're all closing. So the National Independent Venue Association is a lobbyist group, I suppose, working on behalf of the nation's independent venues to lobby those blood-sucking shitbags in D.C., half of whom are on vacation. But go to NIVASSOC.org. That is NIVASSOC.org. And you can straight up just fill out a form, and they will send it for you to lobby your lawmakers. Today's guest is Dave Hawes, a singer-songwriter from Philadelphia, living in California. Dave is an old friend who made a lot of great influential music on his own in a band such as The Loved Ones. It was great talking to him. We had a fantastic and wide-ranging conversation about music and life and kids and everything else. Hope you enjoy.
Well, you know, if all you got to do is squeegee off the roof and you're gaining equity, you're
exactly.
Of
that's what I'm thinking. But how you doing, man? How's the family?
It's great, man. We're trucking along. Everybody's healthy, and you know, for me, as I mean, all the obvious things aside, I'm getting to spend all this concentrated time with my kids in a very formative period of their life. You know, they're like in terms of attachment and all that stuff.
Yeah.
This is so terrific to be home and to be amongst them all day long. It's just like, I mean, it's hard. Obviously, I have two little 19-month-old toddlers.
Yeah.
And one runs towards the street and one runs towards the ocean. You know, that's kind of the way it is. But in terms of like their long-term development and all that stuff, like I'm able to be here, and that's been like the real silver lining for all this. You know, because I guess at this point we're sort of over the utter heartbreak of our careers being upended. You know, like there's a while there where I just was like, this is, you got to be kidding. What are we going to do? And now we're just doing what we're going to do. You know, we're struggling through, and you have to find some kind of peace and mental health or this thing will drive you totally out of your mind. So things are good.
That's good to hear. It's interesting you brought up attachment. I just started learning about something called attachment theory. I don't know if that...
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so there's a list of... there's two books that are on my list I haven't gotten to yet or read yet, but I'm really excited to see kind of where that pans out, what that gets into. That's a whole, like, systems ideas of what happens to you at the very, very beginning of your life can carry on.
It's crucial. And, you know, I mean, my wife is a psychotherapist, so she... In most of these kinds of things, I follow her lead because, you know, I mean, she studied it. And
so
I've read some stuff and just kind of defer to her knowledge in the first place. But it seems crucial. In fact, like things like addiction and all that are tied a lot of times to breaches in attachment in your early age. So it's wild. I mean, it's if all that's true, hopefully we're like giving them really good foundational stuff for later in life.
Yeah,
and save
incredible.
On therapy.
They could save a lot on therapy. Damn, dude. I always say, if it's cool with you, we could just, we'll just roll with this as we start this interview. It's going great.
Whatever you want to do.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I was reading some interviews they did over the last few months. Let's do a couple podcasts. And I find that the story that you have at the beginning of the lockdown, when everybody started to take COVID really seriously, was really interesting, really similar to what we ran into when we were kind of stuck in Australia. So it was your birthday. Can you take us back to what happened there?
It was brutal. We played New York City. I mean, a lot of the final shows of the tour we were on were big mile markers for me, you know, like stuff that the loved ones maybe had done and done well at, but solo I hadn't headlined the Bowery Ballroom, and we were headlining Union Transfer, and everything was like ticking along. You know, we had sold out our Chicago show and the Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto. Like, these were big deals to me. And so the night before, I just heard Benny refer to it as the Rudy Gobert night when the NBA shut down.
Oh, okay.
So that was March 11th.
Yeah.
And we were playing the Bowery Ballroom. We had sold a good amount of tickets. We were looking like we could sell out if we had walk up and stuff. And like, I think 2/3 of the people who had bought tickets showed up, and we were like, uh-oh. And all the while, as that week wore on, we were questioning what are we doing? Are we doing the wrong thing? What's happening? And while we were on stage, the NBA shut down. And it occurred to me, I was like, we're doing the wrong thing. We shouldn't have played here. We shouldn't have played New York City tonight. And so the next morning, we sort of trepidatiously were preparing to go to Boston. And the Philly shutdown, I guess, occurred.
Yeah, the lockdown.
And that show was our final show. So that would have been a couple of days later. And so I talked to my agent. I was like, let's cancel it all. What's the difference between Philadelphia and Boston? Yeah. In terms of safety. And he was like, well, we could still do Boston. I'm like, right, but we shouldn't. And
poor,
it happened
poor to agents. And I think they had that a semblance of that attitude for the next month after that, where they're like, oh, okay, well, we'll book it for August then. Everything will be great by August. And,
that's when we moved it to. It was August.
Months. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and there was still sort of that kind of weird horse trading going on, where it was like, well, we could play three nights at Union Transfer to 200 people, or four nights or whatever it was. And I was like, no, but initially I entertained it, but I was
of
like,
of course,
you know, because you want to figure out a way and you're not sure. But I mean, ultimately, obviously, the proof's been in the pudding. But yeah, it was the morning of my birthday. We're eating at Cracker Barrel, the band and the crew, and the woman didn't bring me my meal. The woman that was waiting on us like forgot my order. So it was like, I'm on the phone canceling all these shows on my birthday, watching tons of money fly out the door. And then I was like, hey, did my food ever? And they were like, oh, we forgot you. You know, so it was just like one thing after the other.
Just completely manifesting itself on their birthday right there.
Oh, it was brutal. It was definitely my least favorite birthday to date. But
that sounds like it sucked, man. And that's brutal for the big life events for you. But that's also like, you know, same as us, Boston, Philly, New York, they're the biggest shows. They're the most well-paying shows for the tour. Like, a lot of the other dates are able to be done because of those shows.
And exactly. Like, and I tend to not run my thing that way. Like, I usually don't like to go on runs where, like, Philly's paying for Cleveland. Or,
sure.
You know how, like, a lot of times that's the way the music business works.
It's totally,
like,
yeah.
We're taking a loss in fill in the blank place. I usually don't do that, but on this tour I did. I was American tour, we're gonna really show our worth here. And thankfully, like, the, you know, people showed up to a stage it show I did the following week. Things are okay. Like, I'm certainly not in as bad a situation as plenty of other people, but it was pretty gnarly. It was definitely a crappy birthday.
Yeah, dude, that sounds terrible. And one other part of it I think you highlighted there was the fact that it wasn't like some of the other tragedies we could compare it to, or massive global events like September 11th attacks happened within an hour of each other, or like some of the other things that are very instantaneous incidences, whereas this was a completely novel, you know, double entendre, novel coronavirus. It was also a novel experience for all of us, where it happened slowly and everybody's interpretation was up to, I mean, there was just no leadership to be able to figure out exactly what we were going to do or how we were going to interpret it, and it just kind of slowly happened. It was super weird. Like, we thought be booking shows a month later, and then, you know, that's not even remotely.
Well, the biggest frustration now that we're in August is that, you know, for as much as I'm like sort of politically minded or engaged or whatever, like, this is the first election in my lifetime where the outcome of the election will directly affect my day-to-day life. Yeah. Because if this year is any indication of how a plague is handled, if he's reelected, the plague won't suddenly get handled. It'll get worse. And I think that'll directly affect whether or not you and I can do the job that we've had for the last decade or two, you know, like.
100% agree, yeah.
So, you know, like for me, making any plans beyond November is probably not, I'm not thinking about anything other than, okay, if Trump's reelected, I probably have to get a different job. And if he's not reelected, then we have a shot. You know, we have a shot at like federal leadership coming in and at least attempting to get a hold on this. I mean, it's possible. You can see in other parts of the world, it's possible to get a hold on the coronavirus, but it hasn't been possible here. I mean, we're a total mess.
And, yeah, totally.
I kind of hate that.
Yeah, it sucks. It fucking blows. It's a total mess in practice. It's been a total mess for the species and for everybody handling it in general. But I think the older that I get, the more I'm realizing that the thing I used to fight against all the time was like braggadocio messaging and shit like that from politicians where they're saying one thing and then doing another. You know, the Democrats on one side for me were just as bad as Republicans in a lot of regards.
Sure.
When it came to war, when it came to wide sweeping economic policies. But this time is the first time realizing that the messaging that's coming from Trump and the White House is so disorganized and bad that it's causing a lot of chaos everywhere and a complete division and divisiveness. And people on one side, on, you know, what maybe we would call our side, are becoming so anti-Trump that if anything he gets right, can't be right. We're like going to be contrarian against it. And on the other side, clearly, you have people acting like fucking maniacs, putting themselves and other people at dangerous risk. You know, it's fucking crazy.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it just boils down to, you know, we're in 2020 and there are lots of complicated problems and lots of people want simple solutions to complicated problems, which you don't get. That's just not the way the world works. And I think the way that information is shared via Twitter and so on, it's all like sort of sound bites or clickbait and so on. So I think it's becoming so, it feels more divisive maybe than it actually is, but yeah, I don't know, man. I guess I hate having to yield that a presidential election will impact my direct life. Like, that's the part of it that today I'm particularly frustrated by. I'm just like, you know, living in a sort of countercultural way, this was kind of part of the design, was like, I can go play songs no matter who's in charge, you know? Like,
yeah.
And now you're sort of coming to terms with like, well, maybe not. Maybe not. It's so, I don't know, man. I think like all of that is swirling sort of back here. And thankfully I have two little weasels that'll be up from their nap soon that will push that further into the back. Like, I have to deal with their immediate needs. And so that's been a welcome and necessary distraction. You know, it's that part of it's really cool. And also I've been focused on recording. Like, I pretty much have recorded an album's worth of material already at home. Which
is awesome. How much are you into like the engineering process on your own beforehand? And I'm sure, you know, you record your own demos and that kind of shit, but what has the pandemic done for you?
Not enough. I think two things. One, most of my heroes, you can sort of trace the point in their career, which is around 40 or whatever, where they get super studio minded. You know, like that happened for Tom Petty or whatever, fill in the blank of people who really got into recording. So I think like naturally I've drifted into that direction, but this has just been sort of a necessity. You know, I have to do something. And I just was like, I can't be that hard to get a vocal sound that's good. I have an Apollo, I have an SM7.
Yeah.
And I know people. I know plenty of people that are willing to help. So I've dug in and started to like do stuff I'm kind of proud of.
Yeah.
Instead of just the demoing, you know, where I was like, whatever, as long as we get the song down.
100%, man. I had spent a lot of time learning engineering stuff back in the day and worked with
so smart
studios, and I really enjoyed it. And now I'm realizing that, you know, people like you, us, we just re-recorded our last record and we did it. Not everybody had that kind of experience, but we were able to pull it off enough to where we engineered the entire thing. And a lot of it is because of the listening part of it. Like you're saying, you could get a good vocal sound. That's because all the notion that there's some kind of magical recipe to follow or equipment that you have to get it to sound good, it kind of goes away when you have an ear intricate enough to be able to just listen to what sounds good. And then when it sounds good, you're like, hey, sounds good.
You're totally right. The other thing that I've found is that it's made me tune in more to music in general. Like when I'm listening to stuff with my kids or whatever, you know, like I like to play Rage Against the Machine with them, for instance. And I'm tuned into the production on that album, which I haven't been for 20 years. I mean, I haven't listened to it in a long time either. But like all of this stuff, when you're doing this day in and day out, and you're like, oh, how did they get that piano sound or whatever? It's really making music more compelling for me. And I'm thinking about music totally different with this sort of newfound thirst for engineering knowledge.
Yeah, dude, it's like a lot of it is the magic of the vocabulary too. You know, like now that you would have certain, you know, just knowing certain words, like as your kids are developing, being able to speak, you can have different thoughts. Like it almost is like a magic spell. Like you can hear the song differently because you now understand what the way to describe what you're hearing, and then you can find that other place. And I think that's really cool.
The interpretation becomes easier with the people you're working with. You know, like there's always that disconnect, or there was for many years for projects that I was working on, where the band would kind of goof around and say like, "Ooh, are you gonna lower the 60 hertz?" And you know, and because we were like the drunken musicians or whatever. Yeah. Like, and it's such as it's. It, to me now, looking back, I'm like, oh my God, we could have just learned a little bit about EQ and been able to deliver our vision easier and quicker to the engineer who's spent all this time and effort really learning what it is we're saying we do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. So, and then you're trying to, hey, can you make it sound less like, make some onomatopoeia? In reality, the engineer just has to interpret that. It's like, I don't even know what this guy's talking about. Like,
yeah, I need it to be greener. It's yeah, like, you know, okay, what the greener. Fuck is that?
Yeah, of course.
I found these things to be, a lot of them are frustrating, I guess, because like, I guess there's just like this punk rock, this dismissive punk rock thing that has crept in over the years. And so now, for instance, like, you know, like I rush. I'm sure we all do. Like you go in and you're looking at your guitar track and you're like, oh, I'm ahead. And it's. You're kind of looking back at your musical journey and going like, well, I'm ahead because I've always been ahead of the beat because we're punk, you know? And those things are so difficult to unlearn over time. And it's similar in the engineering world where you're like, oh, I really do care about this and I really want to understand it. And it's not cool to be like, I don't even know what any of this stuff does. You know, like, it's
like, yeah, that's like a nonchalant attitude that might work like when you're trying to find a girlfriend or a boyfriend in late adolescence, right? Having that shit. But in real life, it doesn't translate at all. You can only be so cool. When you're just fucking the guitar line up and it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder actually now that I've been doing this so much, how interested I'm going to be in tracking guitars and vocals in a studio, you know, for like for the next album. Like,
yeah.
Because you hit sort of a comfort zone where you're like, okay, well, I don't mind that I've punched this 30 times. But man, I bet the engineer would, you know.
Yeah. I bet they're not. Yeah.
Yeah, they wouldn't be stoked. So you sort of wonder, moving forward, if like, well, maybe I'll do the guitars separate. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I guess all bets are off in terms of what's next. But it's been really fun and really exciting and kind of freeing to then like send these sketches and things to the people that I've asked for help, you know, mm-hmm. and have them be like, hey, man, you got that sounding pretty good. I'm like, okay, sweet. You know, it's been a nice, you can sort of trace your progress.
Totally. How does it affect the actual composition that you're making? And what I mean by that is, so we always used to have a little bit of an open notion of like, okay, well, this sounds like this now, but I know that once we get to the studio, it's going to sound different, or I'll have to play it slightly different, but I'm not going to worry about it now because I know that that's eventually going to happen. Whereas opposed to kind of writing now and spending more time focused on the bits and bobs or whatever of it, you can kind of see, you'd be more focused and not have as much of like an open area that could be fixed later. You know what I mean? It's like
I think at the end of the day, like for me, there's still the keystones, you know, like I'll always come back to like, does this thing work? Like if I play this on an acoustic guitar on FaceTime for Tim, my brother, and he's into it, cool. And then when you start to add some of these new, you know, tape loops or reverse piano hits or, you know, whatever, like sure. little new thing I'm learning and like, oh, I can do that now. If that aids the song, great. But I still kind of try to keep those like fundamentals at the beating heart of it. You know, like, do you have a good song? Is the chorus something people can sing? Because in that way, like, I'm kind of basic, you know, like, I like songs to be sung, and
yeah,
I love studio trickery and all that stuff, but we, you know, plenty of bands that get lost in that sauce that where you're like, oh, but you didn't write any songs. It's cool that you showed up and got all these, you know, all the window dressing right. But
yeah, totally. It's a good, nothing there's a window. Romantic notion sometimes with that, where it's like, oh yeah, the accident that I made while I was turning one of the knobs on the Echoplex became the most memorable part of the song. It's not necessarily what we're, you know, going for as like singer-songwriter situations, even at the rock and roll phase. You know, it's not like a...
Right. I still think that at the end of the day, I mean, and the proof's in the pudding in terms of, like, you know, you look at John Prine or Patty Griffin, and whoever, and it's like, well, no, the song is... You look at Rancid, you know, like,
oh, yeah,
any of those bands, you're like, well, no, there's a song, and the production is how you sort of dress that song up, but it can be super interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, like, I just listened to Life Won't Wait again for the first time in like a year or two last week. And I forget how great of an album that is, and how out there and interesting all the way that they recorded everything was. It's fucking so sick.
It's so good, and for whatever reason, I think because they were riding so high off the previous album, you know, so successful, it wasn't thought of as a success.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because it sold less or whatever. I remember hearing that through the grapevine. But
sure,
it
makes sense. I don't think they did as big of a jump from, you know, before Outcome the Wolves as they did into Life Away, and if you're probably just kind of like stasis or whatever, so you might interpret it that way. But it's fucking so good.
Oh my God, just as like as a complete, you know, statement or whatever, like I it might be better than Outcome the Wolves. I mean, maybe not song wise, but yeah, it is tremendous, man. Life Won't Wait is such a great album.
Yeah, dude, amazing. So I wanted to jump back a little bit. You mentioned before talking about taking care of twins, and one thing that keeps coming up when I'm talking to my friends and family while everyone's trying to maintain a kind of, you know, positive mental outlook or good mental health during this is that everybody's bringing on one of the main things is being there for someone else or having to have someone else rely on you. And yeah, I always felt that was a being accountable is always like a great way to kind of get out of that kind of funk, especially when you're, you know, your job evaporates, similar to us that happened.
Yeah. It creates a usefulness that sort of felt like it left the building for a minute there. and it was painful, you know, to because here's the crazy thing about parenting is like, you never feel like you're good at it. Even if you've read stuff, and the fact of the matter is it's frustrating. It's tedious. There are parts of it that are super, I mean, it's terrifying. And so suddenly, like, I've been thrust into a situation where I don't feel that confident. And I used to, for 2019, that was true too, because they were born at the beginning of 2019. But I could go away and feel good about the work I was doing. I knew somewhere, well, I know how to do this. You know, I know how to put on a show, and I know how to sing or whatever. And so I could come back to the parenting role and be like, okay, well, I'm not totally adrift. Whereas, like, without that outlet and without being able to, like, do a job where you're also earning money and so on, a lot of days can feel like I don't know what I'm doing. Am I wrecking these kids? Are they good? You know, so it can be really hard to get all that straight. But, you know, like I said, we're a therapy family, and we all that stuff is taken really seriously. And so hopefully... You know, you strike enough of a balance, and you are useful to these very innocent and dependent beings, and that sort of gives you your daily, I guess, rudder. You know, like for me. So, sure. Are you thinking about having kids? Is that
definitely. Cool. My siblings all have kids, and I grew up in a family where on one side there's like 27 cousins, the other side there's like 32 cousins. So we're just always around kids. Mm-hmm. Definitely want to start a family, and we're engaged now, so we're thinking about doing that sometime
soon.
Oh,
awesome, man.
Yeah,
awesome.
And it is funny to think that people have been raising kids since the beginning of people, but it still just seems like such a confusing, daunting, don't necessarily know what's going on in the situation. I remember where I was with my sister with her first son. She has three sons now. With her first son, he was like, I don't know, maybe 6 months old. And he tripped and he hit his face on the wall, and he started bleeding out of his mouth. And we were like, I was like, well, what do you do when this happens? She's like, I don't know, never had them before. So we're just going to stand there trying to figure out what to do. The kid's blood's coming out of his mouth. And, of course, we Googled it, but I was thinking about, you know, just 10 years before that or 15 years before that, you would just kind of wing it, I guess, you know?
Yeah. It's a lot of it is winging it. You'd think the species would have it together. It's weird. I've had the same – I guess I've had the opposite thought at different points. On one hand, you can't believe the species has even survived.
Yeah, baby, so useless. Imagine being in the woods and having this completely, utterly useless being that can't even move. You know, like
a
baby giraffe comes out, it's running around and shit. Human baby can't do anything for like years.
Right, right. And then on the other hand, I've had the thought where it's like, we really haven't gotten it together. Yeah, you know, like this has been going on for a long time. We still are like pretty much at a loss. I don't know. We're Googling things. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been great though, man. Like I'm psyched to hear that you're looking forward to that. Cause it has been, you know, the greatest thing. It's the only way I could conceive of what we were talking about earlier, where it's like, well, I might have to do something else because I've been so focused on being like a songwriter or being a touring person or whatever. And when that dependency comes, like two little beings that you just love with all your heart, you're like, I'll do whatever. I'll dig a ditch if you need me to. Like, and I think that humbling that comes with children has been great for me.
Yeah, that's so inspiring. That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. I gotta ask you. So your dude grew up in Philly. What's it? How's it been to move to the West Coast?
It's been good.
East Coast, there's some hilarious stigma that goes along with like people from the West Coast or what it'd be like to live there. But I just now, as you go there millions of times, you meet people, you realize a lot of those things aren't true. But what was it like to go over? Like, how was it? Just the weather, being by the beach, the attitude. Oof.
For me, it was as much a culture shock as if I would have moved to England. because, you know, in as many ways, you're leaving what you know. Yes, everyone speaks English, but culturally, California, especially Santa Barbara, is as different from Philadelphia as you can find in an English-speaking place, you know.
I believe that, yeah.
Maybe New Orleans, I don't know. But you know, the weather's great. The beach is great. There's so many wonderful people here. All that's true. But it's been a struggle at points because, I mean, like many East Coasters, deeply tied to my people. You know, I have the same best friends. And I have three sisters and my little brother. And they're like my, you know, they're my main social group, along with these couple best buddies, you know. And so to be that far away, especially when a pandemic like this comes in, and just I can't go see them has been rough, you know. The economic difference, I think, is hard for me to grasp, you know. Like, we live in a place where we can't afford to buy a home, and those home ownership kind of pressures as a working class person, like, you gotta buy a home.
Oh yes.
You know, are really deep-seated in me. I owned two homes back in the Philadelphia area before I got a divorce and came out here, and was happy to leave it all behind then. You know, I was like, oh, I don't want this headache. I don't want to deal with the roof. I don't want to squeegee anything off anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was sort of because of, you know, the failing situation I was in. But now that I'm out here and happily married and have a family, like, that stuff does pull, you know, the like wanting to have our own space and wanting to have my own studio that I won't have to move all this stuff, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. And just the price point out here is like, everything is so expensive.
Yeah, millions of dollars to buy a modest family home. Kind of
situation. Oh, our house is it's great. I mean, there's plenty of space, but it would cost $1.2 million probably to
Jesus
buy.
Christ.
And then it would be knocked over and it would be built in a sort of mid-century modern way or whatever to keep up, and then it would be worth $3 million or whatever. So it's like, yeah, we can rent here. Even that's getting, you know, questionable.
Yeah.
But so some of those things have weighed on me more than I thought they would. But I guess I didn't think I'd be here for very long. I sort of didn't bet on falling back in love and starting a family and all that stuff. So yeah, I do like it. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's California is my favorite state as sort of a fan, but as a you know, like, I'm a fan of it. But in terms of like where I feel the most comfortable, I don't know. I'm just getting comfortable now, you know, like, and it's been, I guess we signed a lease here in 2013. So it's been a while.
Yeah. Damn. Totally. We had, so you had brought up some parallels, I remember, about 2008 to now, and kind of a little bit of the situation that had happened then where the housing crisis had started. It changed the way that venues and shows were done, at least for us. So we moved to Philadelphia in the summer of 2008 or 2007.
No kidding. Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah. That so makes sense.
Right when the housing crisis hit, that like September was, you know, I mean, there was like six or seven of us in one small row home, and that made sense. It was the only thing we could afford. But then it was really the only thing that anybody could afford. And the kind of ways that having shows had changed, you know, they were doing generator shows and shit, but there was a lot of house shows. And non-traditional shows. And I wonder if that's going to repeat itself now that some of the independent venues aren't going to be able to be. I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen next year, but if it does continue along the economic path that we're going right now with all this shrinkage and lack of you know, places to play or people to go and spend money at bars, I wonder if the shows are going to move that direction again.
Well, you know, to some degree, that was a big pivot. 2009-10, I guess, for me, was like the come to Jesus moment on all that. We were in a band, you know, the Loved Ones were like a signed band. You know, we had put out two records, we had done the big support tours, we had a decent enough headlining following. And it seemed like, you know, I mean, I actually think with another record or two, we probably would have been able to make a modest living off of the band, like looking back now. But when that hit and the havoc that wreaked on both of my businesses, because I owned a contracting business with a partner in Philly, and that sort of subsidized my ability to start a band when I was 27, you know, to start a touring band. But when those two things got hit by that same wrecking ball, which was the financial crisis, I realized, like, I kind of have to go solo if I want to play music and make any money. You know, and the other thing was, like, there was no carpentry work. My business dried up, and you know, you could make $200 or $300 a day as a decent carpenter pre the crash. And after that, like, the best carpenters were making that. You know, the $400 and $500 a day guys were like, I'll work for $200. I just got to feed my family.
Yeah, I mean, no one was doing anything to their house. Nobody had any money.
Well, that was the other thing. Yeah, there was no more money to make repairs or upgrades and such. So I got just an offer to go play acoustic through Canada, and it was about the same money. It was like, oh, you can make $300 a show or $200. And I was like, well, plus merch, I'll probably still be ahead. I'll certainly be ahead if I'm going to be home sitting on my ass.
Yeah.
And I'll definitely be ahead even if I got some modest carpentry work. There's nothing to do. So, and that sort of prompted it. I didn't really want to go solo. And still, to some degree, don't feel that. It's like not the most compelling path. I love bands and love collaboration. But that model worked, and I sort of had this weird, like, well, every show's got to have some profit, like, yeah. I was saying earlier, you know, like, I'm like, well, I have to at least not lose money on every single show.
Yeah, of course.
And if that means I sleep in the car, or if that means I don't get a hotel, you know, whatever, fill in the blank ways you can sort of expand and contract how much money you're spending. And that to this day still has an impact. So thankfully, I think even if everything goes to shit, Tim and I can show up and play to 50 people that are gathered who each spend $20 in someone's yard, and we'll walk out of there with a decent living. You know, like, if that becomes the model. And you guys could probably do the same thing despite being sort of like a big rock band now. You guys, because you have songs and you have the interest in playing them in the most stripped down way. And so I think in that sense, like, if live music limps back into place, like, I'll be able to do it in some capacity, just knowing that I have, like, there's plenty of times when we've played in people's backyards or
we actually get over the years have been asked to do that many times. We've done some of them, and I think that guys like you and Chuck Reagan and the likes really laid that a groundwork for that to exist and created like a want for that, you know, like, it really became situations where at least going to see, you know, the revival tour kind of stuff really kind of set a vibe. And here and in Europe as well, where people really wanted to see that, you know, don't necessarily want to get as sweaty or get as crazy or as loud. You don't need the infrastructure in place to have a giant loud rock band where you can just have this kind of moment with the acoustic guitars and get a little bit more
intimate,
visceral. Yeah, intimate with the stories and stuff like that. Yeah, that's pretty.
Cool. We had a wonderful show. We got to open Gaslight Anthem's last run of gigs on 59 Sound a couple years ago, and we got to play two nights at the Hammersmith Apollo. I think it was that. It's always changing names, but it's basically where the Beatles filmed Hard Day's Night. So, I mean, it was massive, amazing. And then we had a day off, and on that day off, we played in someone's garden, you know, for like 100 people or whatever. And it was more profitable and as memorable as playing the Hammersmith, you know, because it was like the complete opposite. And I was really grateful that we got to do both. You know, I was like, this is so cool, because on one hand, you're able to put on the rock show and you know, sort of live out your Eddie Van Halen fantasy. And then on the other hand, you're like delivering the music directly to people with no PA. You know, it's like there's something really cool about that. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm less worried in that sense. But yeah, I don't know, man. I have no idea what's going to happen. It's just, like I said, I think that hopefully there's somewhat of a reset button in January when new leadership takes office. Let's hope we get that far. And then we'll just sort of see what happens. I mean, thankfully for your band, for me, for plenty of our pals, like, we have a European audience that hopefully we can go play to.
Yeah. God, I hope so. That might be happened there before us here, their leadership. And also they had the virus first. So, I mean, at this point, who knows? I guess the only way that the virus is going to go away is if there's a perfect cure, or if we reach a herd immunity, whether that's from a vaccine or because it just tears through the entire species. But yeah, so we'll see. Hopefully that works out there. You know, I know some people that are doing some drive-in shows, not necessarily the most conducive to our kind of music and also our kind of fans. I don't know if they would be into being safely distanced from each other. And also, I think nobody wants to be the band that does it first and have an issue and be known as that band forever. You know, that killed fucking 10 people or some shit like that.
Are you guys sort of just not that interested? I'm not that interested in a drive-in show, frankly. Like, I'll just say it. Like, it keeps coming up, and I'm like, I would much rather play a much smaller and intimate show like we were just discussing than, like, have everyone feel, I don't know, like, play to a bunch of cars?
I'm way more into going to one than I am to playing one. I really want to go to one able to be like, oh, I did. I went to a concert during the pandemic, and this is my experience. I can tell it to my grandkids, whatever. And I can just see how fucking weird it is. But as far as playing one goes, playing one is not something that we're really interested in, besides the fact that it could, well, a lot of people would have a good time and could make a bunch of money from it. But wanting to play one is not there right now. Bands that are doing it, and that sounds like it could be kind of fun, but
You know what it probably would be like? You know when you're shooting a video and you're sort of pretending that you're rocking out to your song? I bet it would be a similar vibe where you're like, all right, I'm going to really mean it, even though I don't get the immediate energy from the crowd. You know what I'm saying? Like, in terms of performing, like, I mean, I love performing anyway, but there is a thing where when you're performing to no one or to a car.
Oh, totally. Well, half of what our performance is like entirely, like, our shtick is the fact that there's an audience there. It's like an inverse flip on itself. There's no, like, we don't have any theatrical part of our band. We're not into psychedelics. Our whole thing is that you're with us and everybody can kind of go crazy and do what they want. And that just completely gone. So I don't know, like, I dance around on stage while it's coming through your radio inside your car. You know, I mean, that sounds kind of funny, bizarre, maybe romantic in its own right, but it's not something that I'm super stoked about. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I saw the Dropkick Murphys do it, and only because I know them did I think, oh, wow, that's peculiar. Like, but when I had tuned out that I knew them and just was watching it and enjoying it, I was like, this is great. Why would you feel weird doing this? Like, they look into it and they're having a great time and it's super well shot and so on. And like I said, only when I thought, oh, I wonder how Al's feeling right now with no crowd there, did it sort of like break down that wall. Sure. So I don't know. It's probably mostly weird for the band, less weird for the people at home. People at home are probably fired, or people in the car. You know what I mean?
That keeps me going on is that if everybody in the car is really wants to be there and hasn't had the same pressure release valves that they've had for months, then that's overall a positive thing despite how I feel about it, but it's still just like, it's fucking weird. And you never know what the deal is. I mean, like, if you're outside, you're told that if you put these measures in place that it's safe. I mean, why wouldn't I believe people who studied this shit for that long? But at the same time, like, I have no idea. You know, I just, it's difficult. You don't want to be in a position of authority in that sense, where you're kind of responsible for everybody there.
I know that is a big thing. It's like, do you want to use your little bit of power for good or for evil? You always want to do it for good. And so any of that line where it's blurred for your own selfishness or your own needs or whatever, you're like, I don't know. I need to make some money, but I really don't want anyone to get, like, one of the great things about what we have been blessed to do is that it does less harm than so many other careers.
Exactly.
You know, it helps. And so to be in a position where you could potentially harm is like, I would rather be on the safer side of that.
Totally. And I think it's a lot harder for younger people to see, you know, specifically the kids in college, graduating stuff, but this might be, you know, the weird year where we couldn't do anything that year. Like, college football is canceled that year, you know, it's like, but the whole thing where with the Eagles mixed with the Steelers one year during World War II, that was like the Eagles. So that's like, that's this year for us. It's just a weird, bizarre thing that we're going to have to roll with, you know? I mean, we've gotten over much worse diseases in the history of all this, so.
Yeah, let's hope it's just this year, you know, that's the big, you know, I mean, if with any real leadership, it maybe wouldn't have been a full year, but sure. Again, I don't know. Hopefully it doesn't go too much further, because we're all going to have to figure something out if it does, you know, something different.
Yeah.
So it's wild.
How'd the stage shows gone for you? How's like playing remote?
They went well. I actually just agreed to do two more shows like that at a venue where there's no one in the venue. And
very cool.
Yeah, it's going to be up in San Francisco, and one of them is solo, and the other one is like me and another singer-songwriter that everyone likes, or everyone that we know likes. So I'm going to try to do those two things, one I think in September and one in November. They're cool. Thankfully, people came, and I had also done them prior, you know, in downtime in other years. I'd like tried them out, and they were successful and fun. Again, you do feel like, hey, people are getting something out of this, even though I don't necessarily get what I'm used to getting out of a performance. And it forces you to kind of think about how you play your guitar and how you sing, and are these in the right key? You know,
you're like, shifting the focus from there's not as much of like, how does this vibe in the room, and more so like, well, they're really going to hear it now. So you got to.
Yeah. So you have to get kind of good, and you have to vary it. At least for me, like I like that extra pressure of having to improve because you're in a new uncomfortable situation. So I liked them. And I guess like I did two of them and then wanted to kind of give it a rest for a couple reasons. One, I get stressed with them. The kids is another reason. And then another thing was like, it just occurred to me that so many people put out albums and can't tour on them.
Yeah.
And if I'm in the way, like, I felt kind of guilty, you know, like I had enough to get by and was like, I'm just going to chill and give it some time, because, you know, like our buddy Brian Fallon put out a record the last day of when we came home. And couldn't play any shows on it, you know?
Yeah, like, that sucks so much.
It sucks so bad. The Lawrence Arms, Jason Isbell, like so many people put out really cool records this year and couldn't tour on them. So there was part of me that was like, I don't necessarily need to clog up every Friday night trying to scratch out my extra money, or, you know, like.
100%. I can totally see that, yeah.
Yeah, so that was just sort of my weird guilt or whatever. So I tightened the belt, and I also wanted to get focused on, like we said, you know, recording and that stuff. Like I definitely in the pandemic have not had downtime, you know, with the kids and all of the other little ambitions, there's like no downtime. So
that's been an interesting facet for me as well. And for us over here too, there's been like enough downtime to the point where Beth and I just finished the entire Sopranos that we watched in like 4 months.
We did too.
Yeah. Nice. Yes. Hell yeah. Glad to hear. We just finished the last episode, I think, 2 nights ago.
So you got the blues. You got the post-soprano blues.
Yeah, I got the post-soprano blues. I think I'm going to take the TV and give it a little break for a little bit, because we ended up watching like an episode or two a day for a run there towards the end. Uh-huh. Got a little heavy, and then realized how like not good watching the Sopranos made me feel.
Oh, really? See, yeah. I loved it. I just was so taken with the third or fourth watch it is now that I'm whatever age I am, 42. I've seen it maybe three or four times all the way through.
Yeah.
And but it's been years, and I was just so bowled over by the amount of humor that's in that show. Dude, oh my
same God. Exact. I did not realize how fucking funny that show was the first time I watched it. It's probably my third watch as well. When I first was exposed to it, like I remember seeing it every Sunday here and there when it was coming out.
Yeah.
I did not remember how hilarious that show was. God
the
damn.
Intervention with Christopher Moltisanti is one of the funniest bits of television I've ever seen. Oh, and by the way, I got a good story. So I guess Michael Imperioli lives in Santa Barbara.
Oh, no shit. That's the guy who plays Christopher.
Christopher, right? Yeah. So I'm in the Trader Joe's some months ago. This is before we I think it must have been right as COVID kicked in, but Tasha and I hadn't started to watch Sopranos. So I'm walking around and I'm going like, I know this guy. This guy's from Philly. How do I know this guy? And I'm assuming he's like a guy I work construction with, or like this always happens to me. I did this with Russell Brand one time. I was at a Morrissey show in Los Angeles and I was like, oh, I know that guy.
That's
I don't
amazing.
Know that guy.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at him and I'm like, and he's kind of looking at me like, I'm like, oh yeah, maybe he knows me too. And it occurred to me after a few aisles of this in Trader Joe's that I was like, oh no, that's Christopher from Sopranos.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's fucking hilarious.
It was. I haven't seen him since we rewatched because I think I'd probably like nerd out on him more that because his performance in that show was, oh my God.
Yeah, it was so good.
So great.
That was another thing I remembered. I think of AJ a lot differently watching it this time.
Me too.
As a character and the actor played him was so top notch and good. Like, yeah.
What? No fucking ZD? That's such a great.
Yeah.
You know who else was a new revelation to me was Janice. I could not stand Janice when I was younger watching it.
Yeah.
And now I kind of had a heart for her because there's so much Livia that she just ended up, that was the card she got dealt.
You're trying to see how much of it is her choice and how much of it is the way that she was just molded, you know?
Yeah. It's, oh my God, what a masterwork of like that art form. And the crazy thing too is like that was the first of its kind in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And not many shows have even come close since.
No, not definitely not. It's like one that really kind of kicked off a lot of those other long form series. I think it kind of showed that people have a really long attention span, you know, compared to what they would think before about TV, where it was kind of just like, you know, writing it just in the moment, you know, like not having no foresight, being like, all right, well, we'll figure out next season later. But Sopranos was like, you know, an epic of a story.
Well, I'm thankful we watched Fleabag after, because that was another instance where the writer said, this is the end. And I think that's always been for me, like the hardest thing with TV is, you know, any good story has an end, which means you have to commit to saying like, this is over, meaning the money train's over, the success train's over. And that is like the mark of a true creative, you know, like, and we don't really have that problem as in our art. We can just keep writing songs.
Exactly. Yeah.
As long as each song ends, we're fine. But in an instance with Sopranos or Breaking Bad or whatever, The Wire, like it's always, or Fleabag, it's so cool when they go like, it's over. We're not going to drag this out. We're not going to like squeeze the commercial money train. We told our story. Like that to me, if a show ends, you know, like it'll get my attention.
Yeah, I really respect the shit out of that. It's pretty awesome. And like mimics the form before it, which would be books, and that existed forever and continue to exist. Like a book can't be stretched that way. Just got to end. You know, like close the cover, it's done. Story's over.
Right.
Well, another part about noticing on this rewatch of Sopranos I didn't notice before is how close it flirts with like Jersey rock culture, you know, like where band people and shit, like where Christopher is producing the band's demo and he goes in, beats the shit out of dude with the guitar and gives him some meth and is like, you finished tonight. And
loved
just like, all those like clubs that existed and those kind of characters that you see in the background, right? Even at the diner in the last scene, there's that like rocker dude and you're like, oh yeah, this is totally New Jersey.
Yes, I was describing that to Natasha when Adriana gets her club. And, you know, we were kind of giggling at the various bands that would play or the goings on there. Yeah. And I was like, I told Tasha, I was like, listen, before the Asbury Lanes and before like any of us became, you know, had enough of an audience to maybe play the Pony or something like that, that's where we would play. We would play these kinds of places that were totally incongruent with our vibe. You know, totally. If you were going into New Jersey to play a gig, it kind of looked more like that than what we now think. You know, now we've had like 20 years of the Souls kind of reimagining the Jersey Shore punk rock scene.
Yeah.
But it used to kind of look like that when my earlier bands would go play Jersey.
Oh, yeah. In high school, we played different venues on Bloomfield Avenue in North Jersey because they would have us. They'd be like, all right, well, yeah, you're a band from Northeastern Pennsylvania. You're all like, you know, 17 and you play ska. Cool. You can play this show, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd show up and it would just be like weirdly competitive older rocker guys and like just any mismatched genre of whatever. Dudes, there was like Slipknot was big at the time. So you'd have a couple guys like putting on makeup at backstage and like getting into like the crazy, like, I don't know, not pseudo goth new metal shit.
Totally. Yeah. The oversharing sound guy loader who's like, you know, had been out with Thin Lizzy or whatever, and you had to know it within the first 3 seconds of being there, you know, that kind
exactly.
of shit. Yeah,
they,
it's
they
wild.
Would do that thing that, like, dudes in Brooklyn would do back in the day where they, like, would do would hand you a demo and not take it back until you bought it. They would do that with, like, the recording of your set. They'd record your set and be like, yeah, record your set, and you're holding it, and they're like, yeah, okay, $50. And you're like, what the fuck?
It's so funny you bring that up because the other day I was thinking, man, it would be great to be putting out some live recordings on Bandcamp or whatever during this time, and I actually had a regret of all the times that a sound guy would go, hey, you want a board recording, it's only $300, and I always was like, nah, I'm good, man. Because I thought I was getting hosed. And
exactly.
Now I'm like, man, I kind of wish in the instances where there was like, you know, Pro Tools file of it all, or you know, like where they had real rigs, I was like, I should have said yes, because there could have been some salvageable thing that we could be using right now. But
for the archive, even some of the lineups of those shows, you just put that up for, you know, whatever, a band camp, a charity or something. And like, this happened in 2008. Holy shit.
I know. It seems more and more like an anomaly. So yeah, it's funny. Those, do you want something off the board? Things are suddenly feeling more valuable than they used to.
Totally. Man, love that. And it is funny how you mentioned not any downtime during the pandemic. A lot of some of the interviews and shit that we've done, where people are talking about how they can't wait for all the music that's going to come out and all that kind of shit. And I feel like some musician situations, there's not going to be that much new music. There's just going to be a lot more bakers, gardeners, and people that are really just kind of taking this time to refigure out exactly what the hell's going on.
Yeah, so I have two EPs. When is this going to air?
I was going to put out tomorrow.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll keep more of a limited amount of, like, we're obviously got to dole out the information strategically, but I'm putting out music in October.
Awesome.
And I'm super excited about it. Tim and I recorded it remotely and got some other friends involved, and it's going to be really cool. It's a cool idea. So, but in terms of writing like a full new album, I'm working on it. Tim and I are writing and so on, but I'm trepidatious, you know, I'm kind of like, well, I'm careful to not include too much about any pandemic related stuff. And I'm careful to consider like putting out something that we couldn't tour on, you know, like all those things are suddenly impeding some of like the ability to think about a full album, you know? And that's so, and I'm not sure if is that true for you too?
Absolutely, yeah. There, and there's also something that you'd mentioned before that it swings into. You're talking about taking up like the digital space and the motivations for doing it, and like people's records coming out. For us, it's also, well, we want to write and record a record. Obviously, that's also the main way besides touring that we can make any money and continue to like have a job. So like, we want to rush write a record and slam it out so that we can get paid. Like, I don't know if we're gonna put. I mean, I know we're probably not going to put out the best record if that's the case. So.
But that's right.
Figure out
that's
what the motivations are for getting everything done and taking the time. And yeah, if you want it to be the pandemic record where every song is like a thinly veiled allegory for being stuck inside somewhere. In fact, I think that this case for you and case for us, our last records did that.
That's right.
Weirdly,
we were clairvoyant.
Yeah, we had it.
Yeah, I thought that too. And I think the way you guys handled putting out the acoustic versions was brilliant. And it was similar to me to what Taylor Swift did, which I also thought was brilliant. It was like, you know, for her, the stakes are much higher in terms of like, well, I can't play stadiums and I won't be able to play them. Maybe
and that's
for
like hundreds of people out of a job too, you know, at that level.
Oh yeah. So for her to go like, well, I'm going to make an album that wouldn't play in stadiums or wouldn't play as well in stadiums. And I'm going to like flex this other creative muscle. That's the kind of that's the kind of music that Tim and I have been working on. It's stuff that we wouldn't have toured on anyway, but it's like those wild ideas you have where you're like, boy, if I had the time, I'd record this. And yeah, so dude.
That's so great to hear.
It's really cool. And it, I like that you guys did a complete, is it every song from the record or?
Yeah, we did the whole record.
The whole record. Okay.
Yeah, it's mostly acoustic centric, but there's some electronic elements and some other stuff that we, like you're saying, normally would just never do. But we recorded it remotely and used different software and new instruments. Yep. And we're like, all right, well, okay, we're going to do it now.
I'm excited about that because one thing I've always wanted to do, like I like to make multiple versions of any song. You know, I like to perform it acoustically or with a piano or whatever, and then also like a rock version. And I wonder now, you know, how it does feel like on the negative side of it, like Spotify needs grist for the mill all the time. Like they want constant content and all this stuff. That's one way to a creative way that I'm excited about, a way to like solve that problem is to have multiple versions of the same song that come out. Because I do think that, I mean, how many times have we heard a song reinterpreted or reimagined and felt closer to that newer version, you know? And how many times have we fucked up, you know, like where you go, like, we didn't record that thing the right way.
Oh, my God. We have whole albums like that.
Yeah, right. So this is, I'm trying to find these silver linings and go like, well, maybe moving forward, you know, when I put out the next full rock album or whatever, if it's that, there's more room to put out all the acoustic versions and be totally... have that be totally the norm instead of like, what are you trying to pull on me here? You know, like I think people might have a new openness and those new patterns could be good for all of us, you know?
Oh yeah. I really hope so. I think there's two parts of that. One of them is the way it's released. So you have all these different versions and it kind of comes out like trickled instead of an album at once. Cause normally we would do the album at once because it's a, you know, to us a big, beautiful piece of artwork that is a snapshot of all those things we're doing in that time, what we wanted to write. And it's also something that we use to tour on. So if you're going to tour on it, you have like 12 songs. It's like a, you know, like how a play would be or like a comedian does it or whatever. It's like a whole block of shit.
That's right.
And if we're not touring, we could just release it when you release a song tomorrow and it would have, you know, similar effects as it would to release part of a whole album.
Yeah. It's good to find the positive parts of this because that's not my default. My initial thing is more like, oh my God, we're fucked, you know? So I've been trying to work at it and be like, okay, well, what's good about this and what can be useful, you know, to take away from this instead of just panic and sadness. Cause you know, there is an element of that, you know, in a year like this.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of pressure to be like, all right, well, I'm not sure if you operate this way, I would imagine. So I'm like, I'll call it an alpha type personality situation, but it's like, I have this time off, so I have to do something. And if I don't, I fail. Like, I have to use every minute of this entire thing. I'm stuck in my house, so that means I have to read, you know, 50 books, and I have to learn this software or write this many songs or whatever. And that's not necessarily the case, but it's also, I think, you can't do nothing. That's would be a really big waste to look back at this time and be like...
Totally. No, I'm with you, man. And I think in the end, like, you got to find whatever balance works, you know, on a day-by-day, week-by-week, basis, because that pressure is another one of those like homeownership pressures, you know. It's just built into you from such a young age, when, you know, coming from where we come from, you know, sort of working class, you got to get one rung up the ladder, you know, which 100%. We know, like, we know is a lie, we know that's a whole rigged system, but
yeah, it's just completely entirely a framework in our minds.
It's a hamster wheel.
Yeah, you know,
that really just generates energy for other people. But it still is so embedded that it's hard to break out of that. You know, it's I've definitely been like, oh, I didn't get enough done. I should have the whole next two records written. It's like,
exactly. What?
My wife's good with this. She's like, you have two boys who can't talk. You know, it's like, you gotta chill, man. Like most people, you know. Whatever. So yeah, I'm with you, man. I think it's hard to know what that balance should be. And the good thing about it is like, we have to lean into the now because we really have no clue what's going to be next, you know, like we have no idea. Yeah. And so you have to figure out at least how to get some joy out of each day and how to get some productivity out of each day.
Hell yeah. I think that's incredible advice. I think it's a great spot to wrap it up too. Now, is there anything else you want everybody to know?
No, just, I mean, all my social media stuff is easy to find. It's just Dave Haas or Haas Dave, some iteration of that. But if you Google my name, H-A-U-S-E, you can find whatever you might like, whether you like Facebook or Instagram or whatever the hell. But no, I don't have anything quite yet to promote other than there is new music coming in October. So I'm super amped. There'll be like a teaser, you know, the first couple songs will come out probably in a month or so. So
hell yeah, man. Yeah. I love that excitement leading up to the point that you have it and can't wait for it to come out.
I'm pumped, so man. I'm pumped. Dude. And hopefully I can take this energy and record the next thing, you know, because like, and like dealing with the limited tools I have here and the knowledge I'm acquiring, like I'll just record the next thing, you know, and see what happens.
Hell yeah. I love that. I love that so fucking much. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, man. But thank you so much for coming on, dude. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm a huge fan and love you guys. I mean, just so pumped on how everything is shook out for you guys. And it was, I was pumped to see the email come in and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Hell yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Man, a huge thanks to Dave for coming on and doing the podcast with me. That was so fucking fun. I'm so glad we got to have that conversation. There are links to his socials in the show notes. Check it out. Follow him up. He said he's got some music coming out in October, which is extremely exciting. If you want to reach me, hit me up at tom@futurefriday.net, and I'll get back to you. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.
Reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like the struggles.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.